final investigator I met with was Dr. Everett Vokes, who began our conversation by commenting on the recent evolution of tissue biomarkers in non-small cell management.
After about 5 years or so of us knowing that EGFR biomarkers mattered, but we were debating which one and when to use them, IPASS was the first time that we could use a biomarker and then say this means that a patient who does not have this biomarker should not get the targeted agent first line, and vice versa could get it first line if there was a mutation. And that has been solidified in the last year with the ALK fusion, where now a second targeted agent has become available, linked to a biomarker, again associated with high response rates and seemingly good progression and hopefully overall survival. That's a little bit premature yet. And there's been presentation, but not publication yet, of the c-MET inhibitor. That was second line, erlotinib plus minus the c-MET inhibitor, presented at ESMO by Dave Spiegel, and then at our meeting in Chicago. Overall, no difference in progression-free or overall survival, but in c-MET overexpressors, a benefit, while in those who did not have it or had it weakly, addition of the drug was detrimental.
What exactly is c-MET, and what's sort of the epidemiology, how often you see it and where you see it?
c-MET is another receptor that can be overexpressed. It can be mutated, but it's not mutated frequently, and we're not sure yet functionally what the mutations mean. But overexpression is observed quite commonly, and you can inhibit it. You can have an antibody to the ligand. You can try to inhibit the receptor itself. And there are two drugs that have been tested. One is ARC, and I don't know the number, that showed in second-line treatment in overexpressors a slight benefit. And now the second agent that's under investigation by Genentech, that in subset analysis suggested that if you add that to erlotinib in overexpressors, they will benefit.
And is this also seen in non-smokers or not really?
That is not so much in non-smokers, and is interesting for that reason as well. It would be a broader population. It's a less specific finding. It's immune histochemistry testing of overexpression. But it opens up further the road into what we call individualization of treatment. And that really is the trend of the last year, where before we talked about it, we can now actually see that happening. You could actually argue that it isn't the right term, individualization, that what we've done all these years as oncologists is find clinical and pathologic markers that group patients, and that work is getting more refined. And so I view this as a more refined grouping of patients as opposed to true individualization.
What are some of the clinical trials that are out there right now that you're most excited about, you know, looking at the whole span of lung cancer?
Well, I think the EGFR story is not completed yet in terms of earlier stage disease. So Radiant is pending and is a randomization to adjuvant erlotinib in early stage disease. That should be very informative.
Now, that's just an EGFR mutation positive patient?
And FISH positive. So it measures more than one parameter, but those are known parameters and can later be subset analyzed. Then similarly, bevacizumab, we really don't know who should get it and with what regimen. So you have a positive trial for survival in stage 4 disease in combination with carboplatin paclitaxel. You have a positive, by definition of the trial parameters, a trial with cisgemcitabine for progression-free survival, but not survival. And so is it regimen-specific? Is the effect small so that sometimes you see it, sometimes you don't see it on survival? How does it compare to cisplatin pemetrexed or the addition of bevacizumab to that combination? Those are the kinds of questions I would like to sort out.
How about locally advanced disease? Can you talk a little bit about where we are right now and what are some of the trials looking at it?
Locally advanced disease used to be exciting. So we had trials, we figured out how to add chemotherapy, we figured out we could give it as induction, we could give it concurrently. Nice meta-analysis published last year that looked at all these trials of concurrent versus sequential, and concurrent wins for survival and has a positive trend for progression-free survival and local control, and for distant control, they're both good or the same. But we have not made a lot of progress in recent years. And I think there are a few factors responsible for that. One is we stage more precisely, so the number of patients in this cohort is getting smaller. And for two, we recognize the clinical heterogeneity of this population. So N2 disease can be subdivided easily into single station, extracapsular spread, other parameters that tell us it's not all the same. And yet we don't truly distinguish in a non-surgically treated population of patients with precision to know are there difference between different trials.
How do you approach the issue of post-chemo radiation systemic therapy? You know, this was looked at in the HOG study. I'm not sure what other data we have on that question, but how do you approach it?
The HOG study is the only one that truly looked at docetaxel the way SWOG tested it. It's a small study. Patients got chemo radiation with cisplatin etoposide, and then either observation or docetaxel for three more cycles, and there was no difference. I tend to believe the study, even though it was small, because I think it was fairly rigorously conducted, and there is no room between the curves. So the evidence as it exists would tell us there may not be benefit from giving more than two cycles. The problem with that is it's not intuitively correct. If in stage 4 disease and in stage 1 disease or early stage we give four cycles, why in the intermediate stage curative setting we would give less than that is just not clear or logical. And in practice, current randomized trials actually give more. And so you have an absence of conclusive benefit from more cycles, because really the question is what's optimal cycle number? And then a popular vote default mode that says, well, it's probably somewhere around four cycles.
So how do you approach that outside of protocol setting in your own practice?
I think if you look at the control arm for one of the current trials, which evaluates pemetrexed as a radiation sensitizer, the control arm is cis-etoposide radiation for two cycles of cisplatin given on day 1, day 8. And then allows two more cycles of cisplatin-based treatment afterwards without specifying the second agent. And I think that's a good compromise.
So is that what you do, and what do you add to cis?
In practice, we use cis-etoposide still. You could use carbo and paclitaxel, but at our institution, we feel that the data are a little bit better for cis-etoposide. And then if it's adeno, we give cis-pemetrexed, and cis-gemcitabine would also be an option, or cis-paclitaxel.
Where are we with EGFR antibodies in terms of locally advanced disease?
Not where we know what we're doing. The SWOG study 0034 looked at the whole SWOG package, chemo-RT followed by consolidation docetaxel with randomization to either gefitinib or observation, and the control arm did better than the addition of gefitinib. And when you see such an outcome that the hypothesis of patients doing better with gefitinib, not only is it not happening, they're actually doing worse, you have to be very, very careful. We have discussion now in CLGB of looking at EGFR mutated patients and treating them with induction gefitinib, and then following that with chemo-RT standard. So it's not adding it to chemo-RT. It is the concept to test a systemically active drug in stage 3 disease in a highly susceptible population of patients with mutant tumors, and then giving the standard chemo-RT for local treatment.
And of course, the SWOG study was for all comers. They didn't look at mutations. Yeah. Is that a strategy that you ever utilize outside a protocol setting? You have a patient with a known EGFR mutation, either using upfront erlotinib or post-chemo radiation?
I don't do that, no. And the reason is the worry about doing harm. That comes from the SWOG study and comes from BR19, where patients were randomized to adjuvant gefitinib or not, or erlotinib or not. And while the study closed early, and we have to be concerned that the interpretation of the data is not very refined, the data as they were presented at ASCO last year showed no benefit.
How about EGFR antibodies, specifically cetuximab?
Well, RTOG has interesting data, adding it to carboplatin paclitaxel radiation. And it's a phase 2 study, and George Blumenschein presented it at ASCO, I believe, in 08. Don't think it's been published yet, but the 2-year survival was 50%. And the data then would suggest that that's better than what we've seen for most carboplatin-paclitaxel-based chemo-RT trials. So there could be benefit, and that's being tested in the randomized setting now.
What's the design and who's doing it?
It's an intergroup trial, and patients are randomized to carboplatin-paclitaxel radiation with or without cetuximab. There's a second question built into it, so it's really a four-arm trial. And that question is 60 gray better or 74 gray? So what's the role of intensifying radiation? And so two hypotheses being pursued, looking at low dose versus high dose plus minus cetuximab with a carboplatin-paclitaxel backbone.
What about safety and toxicity? What do we know about that right now?
We know from the RTOG trial that the addition of cetuximab is perfectly safe. The head and neck data would suggest that also, where it was added to radiation. For the high-dose radiation, we have several smaller pilots in CLGB, in SWOG, in RTOG, and they all tell us that up to 74 gray, it is safe. Mark Sosinski and his team have also done a lot of work on that.
Anything that you see docs in practice doing in terms of locally advanced disease, you know, that you get patients referred who've been treated in the community that maybe they could be doing better, or anything, any myths about the approach to it that you see?
I think when it comes to combined modality therapy, the key issue is coordination. So making sure that doses are given on time, that they're given in the right amount. So protocol adherence, in a way, or regimen adherence, since these are off protocol, is one concern. So I think the idea of balancing a curative intent regimen versus the acute toxicities that, of course, we have to be concerned about and that patients complain about, but to not overreact to toxicities such as mucositis or esophagitis is important. On the other hand, a toxicity such as pneumonitis, you have to react to because it could be life-threatening.
So when you say overreact, by doing what? Stopping therapy?
Stopping therapy. More than anything, an interruption of radiation is something you want to avoid if you can. Dose-reducing chemo is less known to be detrimental, although intuitively here too, the systemic aspect of what you want to give is important, and to back off from that could be detrimental.
How do you approach, for practical purposes, prevention and management of toxicity, and when do you back off on radiation or chemo?
So shortness of breath, clinical signs of pneumonitis, I would consult very closely with my radiation oncologist and evaluate that patient carefully. For esophagitis, on the other hand, that's to be expected to some degree. All of this has gotten better with IMRT, by the way. But there, you can frequently support the patient with occasional IV fluids or other supportive care measures, pain control, and discussing with the patient that you're talking about 5-6 weeks of treatment, and they can frequently end up making it through just fine. The other thing for stage 3, I still see patients getting induction chemotherapy and then getting concurrent chemoradiation. Those two together, unfortunately, have not been shown to be better than concurrent chemoradiation alone. So while it can be a situation where somebody should get induction chemo because they're not ready for concurrent upfront, or they may not be able to withstand it, to first give induction and then concurrent is not something I would recommend.
So let's talk about metastatic disease. We'll start out with squamous cell.
Squamous, I think, is becoming hard for us to point to progress in recent years. We don't have a good target, maybe cetuximab, but we don't have very clear data on that. We know that pemetrexed is not the best regimen for these patients, so what we're left with is carboplatin or docetaxel. And, of course, based on Scagliotti's trial, cisplatin and gemcitabine. And I think those are good options, or those are the options we have. They're not good enough, but those are the options we have.
How about adenocarcinoma?
For adenocarcinoma, I think pemetrexed rules based on the Scagliotti trial. And, of course, bevacizumab rules. So those two, we don't know one or the other, or both, adding bevacizumab to pemetrexed. But I think there we have options. And of course, we also have targeted therapies for some of those patients now, because that's where we see the mutations of both EGFR and, of course, the ALK fusion. So nab-paclitaxel and adeno is not something I would see us use much.
What about bevacizumab? How do you go about making that decision?
I think it's a hard decision. If you have a clear-cut bevacizumab case, adenocarcinoma, no EGFR mutation, I think giving carboplatin bevacizumab is perfectly reasonable. The alternative is carbo or cis pemetrexed. There are phase 2 data for carbo pemetrexed and bevacizumab, but the comparative data of that regimen versus carboplatin bevacizumab are pending. Until then, these are all equally valid options. Personally, I like just the doublet of cis or carbo and pemetrexed.
How do you go about deciding whether it's cis or carbo?
It's carbo in stage 4 disease.
Any comments on the presentation? It seems like it was so long ago, but I guess it was the last ASCO. That was soon thereafter published in the New England Journal, looking at the benefits of palliative care.
Larry Einhorn wrote a very nice editorial on that. So what you had was patients getting chemo, and then the addition of palliative care to that, showing that those patients lived longer and did better. And what I very much like about that trial is that it reminds us to be complete doctors, to take care of the patient, to give that supportive care, and to think about doing it. Where the trial, I think, falls a little short, best as I understood it when reading it, is that it doesn't really define carefully what one group got that the other didn't get. And then Larry Einhorn in his editorial questioned just the size of the difference, I believe 2 to 3 months in survival, and said, we don't see this easily in stage 4 lung cancer. Why here? So again, there's a little bit of intuitive questioning as to what really is going on here. But in terms of what we should take home from that, it's a good message, which is treat the patient, not just the tumor.
What about management of older patients? There was a presentation again at ASCO last year. What was your take from that, and how do you approach the patient 70, 75, 85?
You know, Neil, we have in CLGB a longstanding interest in that question. Rogerio Lilienbaum brought that really to us in the 90s. And Rogerio did single agent versus doublet, paclitaxel versus carboplatin. And there was a benefit, a trend for a better outcome, and that included elderly patients. And there's been over the years more evidence like that. And where I think you're at is if somebody has good performance status and good end organ function and is, in other words, biologically a younger person, by all means, give them doublets. What we don't know so much is what about the truly elderly, over 80 and beyond, how should we best treat them? We're trying to test that a little bit further. We in CLGB have discussions. What are the relevant questions there? Is it single versus doublet? Is it better selection of patients for which we need better parameters? And I don't think we have the answers. In my own practice, I would treat somebody with doublets as long as the performance status is supporting that.
85, 90?
I have never done it. I might start with a single agent.
It's funny, people say, yeah, you just, in all the tumors, everybody always says the same thing. Well, it's their performance status. And then you really start looking at it, and I guess it's a little bit shakier as you get older.
I think what you see is patients coming in with good performance status, and you get one cycle, and they're just having a hard time tolerating it and recovering from it.
Any questions that you get from oncologists in community-based practice, either, you know, in the process of interacting with them or consulting or in meetings like this one, any common questions about lung cancer they ask you?
Common question is use of gefitinib in earlier stage disease. And as we discussed, we just don't know the answer, but we'll know the answer, at least for the adjuvant setting. We won't know it for a while for intermediate stage. There is a common question around cetuximab because we have positive trials, but they're marginally positive, so a suggested benefit, but we don't really know what patient, what regimen. And then around how to test tumors, what do we need to know? And I think that's a really evolving field where lung cancer has lagged behind other common tumors, colorectal or breast cancer, but we're getting there. And I think for adenocarcinoma, at this point, EGFR, and I think increasingly ALK testing, KRAS is going to be something we will do.
So even though this interview is for a lung cancer program, I can't sit down and talk to you and not ask you about head and neck. So maybe we just talk a couple minutes about that. Again, from the point of view of the oncologist in practice, what are some of the things going on right now in head and neck you think they need to know about?
Head and neck is highly curable. So 70% of patients present without metastatic disease, but locally, regionally advanced. And we have options, and we cannot differentiate those options. Unlike in lung cancer, where concurrent chemoradiotherapy won in direct comparison, in head and neck, we don't know. So you can use TPF, docetaxel, platinum, and 5-FU as induction chemo. You can use a concurrent chemoradiation regimen, usually cisplatin. And you could use, but it's based on only one trial, cetuximab radiation. All three are viable options. All three are tolerable. All three are given with curative intent. And we have no evidence that combining them is better than using a single one. So having said that, what I would consider a standard that I would use most frequently is concurrent chemoradiation. I think that approach has the most trials, the most positive trials, the biggest database, and followed by induction chemo with TPF. Cetuximab is intriguing. It is a little harder to evaluate in my mind because the control arm of its positive trial was radiation only. So we don't really know how does it compare to chemo RT. Those are questions that will be answered. So RTOG has a study looking at cis and radiation plus minus cetuximab. That will be very interesting. We have a study that we led out of University of Chicago that looked at chemo RT plus minus induction. So the addition of more systemic therapy. And, you know, arguably you could use induction followed by radiation and cetuximab. The other interesting phenomenon in head and neck cancer is the changing epidemiology. So we have a clear new clinical or pathological subgroup of patients, oropharyngeal patients, tumor patients, with an HPV etiology as opposed to smoking etiology. We know prognostically that is a good parameter. Those patients do better. And that seems to also be the case whether they get cisplatin concurrently or induction.
What do we know about the mechanisms of transmission of HPV?
It's sexually transmitted, and it's linked to promiscuity, probably to oral sex practices. But, of course, we don't know enough about the latency, about other predispositions. it is still male dominant at a ratio of about 3-1. So some aspects are the same as in the smoking related tumors, and we don't really understand fully yet. It's located in the oropharyngeal area, Waldeyer's ring, so base of tongue and tonsils. Biologically, it may differ a little bit with a higher propensity to spread to lymph nodes and do so earlier than the more smoking alcohol-related cases.
Are there any practical implications in terms of patient care, in terms of diagnosing HPV or not?
We treat them the same way at this point, but if you look at other HPV tumors, particularly anal cancer, then you can't help but think that lower radiation doses might be sufficient. And we need to sort that out. Do you need that much aggressive treatment for these patients as you do for smoking-related tumors? Hard to pursue in clinical trials because what you're doing is giving less treatment. So the risk might be that at some threshold value, we're actually curing fewer patients. And do we have enough sensitivity or specificity in the trials to find that threshold early? That's the worry I have there.
Anything that we haven't talked about that you would cover in a talk or, you know, that you think is important to talk about in terms of either of these topics, lung cancer and head and neck?
Head and neck, I would point out the absence of biological markers other than HPV. So HPV is something that's worth knowing, although clinically it is a subgroup you can define, but it is worth knowing for prognostic matters, and you can test it, the pathologist, for HPV or P16. But beyond that, we have no mutations or other prognostically relevant or predictive parameters.